Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM.
Music too?
Honey, I live music. Morning, noon, a whole night. Everything else is just icing on the cake, you dig?
I do.
This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special, the night we get someone in to pick the music. And I'm delighted that tonight my guest is Jessica Traynor, who I know sort of, I call Jessica a poet, but there's more to it because she's a writer, she's a dramaturg, and she's a creative writing teacher and various other things. So, Jessica, will poet do for tonight?
I think poet is a good hat to wear tonight.
It is. It's a hat to wear with pride, I think, if you can afford to.
Absolutely. Well, that's another story.
if you have earned the hat. So, Jessica, we'll get into all this obviously later. What a dramaturg is. And all. Have I even pronounced that correctly?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Hard G.
Yes. So, Jessica, Dublin credentials in your case. You're Talla?
Born in Talla, yes, yeah, and then moved around various different places, north, south, wherever, have defected from one side of the river to the other a number of times, but I'm now a proud North Sider.
Right.
Yeah, the North Sider thing has stuck, I think.
And what was, we've had a few guests on the programme before who grew up in Talla, and I think you might be the youngest of them, so maybe your experience isn't the same, but they talk about it being like partially the countryside, really.
Yeah, I think I probably was too young to have really gotten out into it too much.
Yeah.
And I think most of my kind of my youthful experiences wandering around in the way that you could still in the 80s and 90s would have been much more kind of urban than that.
Yeah.
You know, we moved in closer to the city. We went from Talla to Rathgar, which was a shock for all the neighbours in Rathgar for a little while. We were a curiosity. And especially because my dad was from Finglas as well. And my mum was from Walkinstown, so there were kind of, you know, we were really compounding the circumstances of having come down from Talla. So we lived in a house in Rathgar that my parents would have bought. It was basically derelict, and we had to live in one room of it for the first while, and there were holes in the roof, there were infestations, there were, you know, to the extent that when we moved into the house, it had been empty for about 6 months, but the previous tenants' food and meals were still on the table.
Oh, that's a bonus.
Really, yeah, but it was pretty gothic stuff, you know, it really was. So,
at what age were you then, Jessica?
I would have been about three, I think, at that stage.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, that was.
So, you're really a Rathgar person.
I am, yeah. I can't lay claim to being, you know, a representative of Talla, but no more can I really lay claim to being a representative of Rathgar, because we stayed there for a while, and then my parents separated and moved to different sides of the city. My dad went back to his native North Side and lived right beside Croke Park. And when me and my partner bought our first house about 10 years ago now, we moved just around the other side of Croke Park. So that would have had that whole area, the kind of the Joneses Road area, you know, and all of its, all of the hinterland, all of the very Joycean hinterland around there, right the way into Mountjoy Square, would be kind of a spiritual home as well still, even though we've moved from Ballybock, where we were a little bit further out to Artane now.
Now, I've been looking at your list. There's some great choices on here, all sorts. PJ Harvey's coming up, Smashing Pumpkins and all kinds of things. But your first choice I see is Vivaldi, Four Seasons. Did you hear that on the radio, record player, where?
We had a little tape recorder, a little cassette player. You know, and it's again that the technology has become so obsolete now that I don't even know what it was called. It was basically you stuck the tape in and you press play. But my mum was very keen when I was growing up for me to experience things like classical music and reading and writing and art. And it was all really important to her. And she had a kind of a programme, you know, and the Vivaldi was part of the programme. We had a couple of tapes.
And did she know anything about it herself?
Oh, she did. Yeah. No, she would have been, both of my parents would have been really, really keen in terms of arts, literature, that kind of thing, despite the fact that they both might not have come from backgrounds where that was traditionally a huge part of life. You know, my dad was a keen writer. My mum went back to become an actor, and they were really keen for me to experience the arts. And this Vivaldi tape was part of it. It was the Four Seasons, and my mum used to stick it on to help me get to sleep at night.
First choice of my guest tonight, Jessica Traynor, is from Vivaldi's The Four Seasons. That's the first movement, and performed there by Sarah Chang with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. Jessica, we're in Tala, then we were into Hrathgar, and your parents were people with an artistic background, and it was your mother in particular who was encouraging you to get involved in the good things in life. Were you a good student?
I was, yeah. I loved school. I really, really enjoyed it. Probably up until secondary school level, where life became more complicated, as life becomes more complicated for everybody.
And school becomes a little bit boring, doesn't it?
Yeah, it becomes a little bit boring. But then there were also things like I was great at languages and I was great at English and history. Whereas, you know, when I was up until about 12, I was great at maths. But then when we went on from just memorising 12 times tables and stuff like that into the kind of more difficult conceptual stuff, I struggled with that. And I think that, you know, I didn't know how to be bad at something in school. So that was a challenge, you know. And I think, you know, in the adult world and in the work world, we can all compartmentalize. We can all decide, okay, this is the week to focus on this and this is the week to focus on, you know, but you don't have that ability in school. You know, you're kind of running from one thing to another. And it is really difficult. And yes, yeah, then things like kind of especially hormones and teenage dynamics. And especially for me, I was in an all-girls school.
Yeah.
And the dynamic of all-girls schools, I mean, all school dynamics are challenging, but I found that one particularly challenging.
So what would you say about I went to an all-boys school and I have very little to recommend that experience of an all-boys school. But what about an all-girls school? Is it in your view, good idea, bad idea?
Oh, you know, it's so hard to know. You know, they do say that girls do better in all-girls schools and boys do better in mixed schools. And I, you know, I suppose it depends on what you want or what you need from the school experience. You know, I think that I was very convinced that academia and getting your high points was the be-all and end-all. Whereas now I look back and think, you know, you did an arts degree, Jess. You know, they are what you make of them. And it was lovely to go to Trinity. But I probably would have been just fine if I'd gone to UCT or if I'd gone to Maynooth or if I'd gone to DC or wherever. Do you know what I mean?
And what about if you hadn't gone anywhere? Have you thought about that?
Oh, that wouldn't have worked for me, I don't think.
No.
Yeah, no, I think I needed it. I think I needed the time. And actually, it's funny. I think sometimes people can think that a degree at that time in your life is something that sets you off on a route that you can't escape from.
No.
But I think in today's world, the notion of not having that grounding, you know, first of all, okay, it's a bit of hard work for a couple of years, but it means that you're not having to pay, you know, you're not having to work to pay a mortgage. You're not having to work to support a family.
And it's a bit of a buffer between leaving school and growing up.
I think so. And I think if it were clearer, or I think if students were helped a little bit more from the transition from rote learning, which I was really good at, to this is your idea and your take on things and here are the ways that you structure your arguments, I think, you know, that's a really difficult transition for people. And I didn't get it, you know. I mean, thankfully, Trinity was a 4-year degree, so I was allowed to be really bad in the first year, because it just took me a while to make that transition from one way of thinking to another. And that's a kind of a seismic shift. And I don't know how you tell people how to do it. It's like saying, go on and ride that bike there without your stabilizers. You know, you can't really tell somebody how to do that. So, yeah, I fell over a lot in the first year.
Your next choice is Leonard Cohen, I see, who by fire, I was going to suggest maybe that was in your university years, years, but that was in your house, was it?
Yeah, that was actually, this is memories of childhood holidays in Wexford, strangely enough. And my parents had all these vinyls that they had recorded onto tapes. And we used to listen to this and lots of other songs, Neil Young, Al Stewart, lots of other kind of, I suppose, folk-tinged music of the time. And then there was also like Carly Simon and stuff like that too, and Carole King. But the mystery of this song has just stayed with me. I think it's fabulously poetic.
By Fire from Leonard Cohen. Jessica Traynor is with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. Jessica is a writer, poet, dramaturg, teacher, and all the rest. We got a bit lost there talking about the education system that you went through. But when you got to Trinity, what were you studying for a start?
I was studying English literature with history.
Right. And was that a pleasure?
It was, yeah. It was a pleasure. I mean, again, like all of these things, I'd love to go back and do it again now.
Yeah.
You know, knowing what I know, and being a much more chilled out person and happier in my own skin.
Students should be told that on day one.
Yeah.
Just give this everything, because when you're older, you really will want to do it again.
The luxury of those couple of years. Yeah.
And the idea, I mean, I mentioned this earlier about not going to college at all. There's a lot of people I know, hugely successful in their fields, and I'm talking about artists, you know, and musicians and one thing and another, who either didn't go or left, you know, to pursue the thing that they wanted to do. And, you know, they did really well. And they're the smartest people I know, all the rest of it, but they never went to college. They found their own college, in a sense, you know.
You know, it's interesting. I'm on this panel of UCD Creative Fellows, and Paul Brady is on it.
Well, there's
actually
one case
and
in point.
He was talking about that exact dynamic. But I think the world has changed, and not necessarily for the better, in a number of ways. And I think that, you know, arts and literature in particular has become so taken into the academy. Mm-hmm. That it's very, very difficult to be successful without those kind of links in some way, shape or form. And I think especially in the world of poetry. Now, look, it's a wonderful thing in some ways. It's giving lots of young poets the chance to really focus in on kind of postgraduate studies in the area of poetry. It's giving them that space that we were just both talking about valuing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, with the rowing back of free access to college education, it's a narrower field of people who are having those opportunities. Now, I did a master's in creative writing back in 2007, 2008 in UCD, but I still benefited hugely from a grant in order to cover those fees. Nowadays, it's not as easy for people, and fewer people can afford that luxury. You know, the world has changed with the recession, and also these kind of registration fees are going up and up and up until they're basically resembling fees. But it's just really, really hard now.
But when you say, you know, when you do a master's in, what was it, creative writing.
Yeah.
And there are various very well-known courses, particularly in England as well, creative writing courses. But at the same time, I'm talking to you and you're someone who can write and has written books. You might have written more books if you hadn't been doing that course. You know what I mean? Or maybe you wouldn't have.
I don't think I would have, because I think that when people ask me, especially when younger writers come and say, should I do a creative writing master's? And I say, well, do it if it's not going to put you under undue financial pressure, because you're never going to write anything if you're worrying hugely about money. And do it absolutely for the benefit that you'll get of coming across these wonderful established writers. That's wonderful. It's a luxury. And for the time you will have to write. Nobody else is ever going to give you a year and say, write.
Mm.
But, you know, really the most beneficial thing in those courses, or that comes from those courses, is the creation of a network of peers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not necessarily saying you become best friends with your lecturer and they open all the doorways to publishing for you, you know, but even just other people who are at your stage of taking their career seriously. Because in the writing world, you know, it can feel, you're very isolated a lot of the time as a writer. But if you can meet those peers, hang on to them, encourage each other, you will have a better chance. And my first book definitely came out of kind of clinging to those little life rafts, you know, when I was working away, because obviously I had to go and get a full-time job. Now, I was lucky enough to get a full-time job working within the arts in the Abbey Theatre, but that was very all-consuming. A recession hit, you know, just as I stepped out the door of college. You know, we'd bought a house, there was a mortgage to pay. And I think without having had that structure, I would have found it more difficult to succeed. Mm. But there are other people, and you see a lot of them who just say, OK, I'm going to run away and walk barefoot across Asia while writing the great novel, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that really suits some people as well. But I valued the structure that was offered to me by the whole experience.
Interesting to hear that. We'll come back to this. Code Eye, you mentioned on your list here. A version of Ave Maria. Was this your childhood? Were you still in your childhood, musically speaking?
Childhood right the way up to, I suppose, my late 20s. I was in a choir called Country Oga Ohaclia, a wonderful choir conducted by Brian O'Doole, who's now passed away and is now conducted by Brian Dungan.
Were you a good singer?
I'm a decent enough soprano. Yeah.
So, and would you have sung solo as well?
I very rarely sang solo. I might have once or twice, but we were a big enough choir. You know, we did a lot of 6 and 8 part pieces. But from the age of around 12, this was one of our staples. And again, much like the Vivaldi, it's a really complex piece of music, kind of modern Hungarian church music. And, you know, we really enjoyed having the opportunity just to be kind of go sing it.
I've got a version of it here from, do you know this album?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's from the Country Oga album, which I think came out in 97 or so. So I think just before I would have become involved. So I'm not on that on this one, but
we can pretend you are.
It'll be lovely to hear it.
Here it comes. Jessica Traynor with me in studio tonight. And Jessica was in that choir, Cantari Oga Altlia. Tell me more about that choir.
So they were founded in the 1960s, I believe, by a guy called Pruntius O'Kelly, who did a lot of different musical arrangements of Irish traditional songs that we sung over the years. Then Brian O'Doole took them over. And Brian was a wonderful kind of part of the Irish music community. I believe he was the first school's inspector for music in the country.
Yeah.
And he worked with us until his death. And just, you know, we travelled all over the world. We sang in lots of different competitions. We were never professional, so a lot of us, including myself, would have learned by ear rather than being able to sight read. But we kind of know he never let it hold us back. We sang really, really complex music. And the choir is kind of it's come back to life now. Bernie Sherlock of New Dublin Voices took it over and then passed it on to her son, Brian, recently. And I think they've just been off winning lots of different prizes around the world. And I keep threatening to go back and join again.
And that version of Ave Maria by Kodai.
Yeah.
So there was a wide repertoire.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Lots of kind of Hungarian, big fan of Hungarian kind of contemporary composers of the mid 20th century, like Bartok and Kodály, and then lots of traditional Irish stuff, and then lots of kind of sacred music, Palestrina, Vittoria, those kind of.
Now, I haven't sung in a choir since I was in school, but since my voice broke, a lot of people who are in choirs, you know, they'd all say the same thing. It's the most marvellous feeling of singing with other people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's that kind of, you are in the midst of all of that sound, yeah. You know. It's as much of a pleasure to do as it is to listen to. But I think it really speaks to something that I love about choral music, is it kind of restores your faith in humanity, yeah, to a certain extent. Like, can you get this bunch of people together? And especially in choirs, there's always various different, she's annoyed with him and he's annoyed, you know, all these different little dynamics going
her,
on.
Yeah.
And then everybody comes together, yeah, and they make this beautiful music. Yeah. And you know, I think that we there's a lot of discord in the world at the moment, you know, but there is also always the potential for harmony, and just exposing yourself to that, yeah, and reminding yourself of that, I think, is really important.
Oh, it's very moving, even at a football match.
Oh, yeah.
People singing, you know.
Absolutely. Mm. And you can see that in the faces of the people on the terraces, you know, how much it means to them to be able to express themselves that way. Togetherness is so important.
And what age were you when you were in that choir?
I would have started when I was about 11 or 12.
Okay.
And sung with them up until I was probably about 28 or so.
All right. You know, with That's quite a commitment, a few, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, with a few gaps. I mean, I lived away for a year and a half and, you know, I've kind of, and as I said, I am still threatening to rejoin because I just miss it, you know, it's good for the soul.
And a lot of kids, of course, they associate choirs with school, singing songs. They're not really interested in singing, although now and again you might be touched by something. But what often happens is you get distracted by other forms of music that you discover for yourself. And, you know, singing about fairies in Donegal becomes less attractive. Shortcut through the Rosses. I don't know many times I went
Absolutely.
Through that. But, you know, it's you obviously weren't dragged away from it by all the other discoveries you were making.
Yeah, no, not at all, actually. And I think it was because of Bree and our conductor's choices were always very dramatic. You know, it was challenging stuff. It was difficult stuff. We never found ourselves singing, you know, why do birds suddenly appear, you know, in three part harmony. We never went for that kind of twee stuff.
Yeah.
So even when I was like a teenage rocker, which I very much was, you know, I could still wear the black eyeliner while singing the choral songs. It's still, the two things still fit together. There was a similar sense of kind of drama, I think, about the music that I loved in the choir and outside of the choir.
And as a teenage rocker, did you join any particular tribe?
Oh, you know, it was a bit fluid in my, you know, I grew up in the terrible dark days of new metal. You know, there was a terrible musical famine, I think, in the early 2000s, which is when I was a teenager. You know, grunge had just died and gone away. But we all still loved grunge. And then there was this awful kind of white rap metal stuff going on. You know, so there was kind of a scrabble to find out where you belonged when you didn't necessarily want to wear, you know, a red baseball cap and baggy trousers. So I was kind of a goth, but I was a goth who was also occasionally kind of a hippie and a grunger and all of these different things. You know, there was a bit of a one size fits all. And I think it was such a small community that, you know, nobody really stuck to the dress code too much.
Well, let's go to those musical years then. That's Throwing Muses and Shimmer, the choice of Jessica Traynor, who's with me in studio tonight. And so that's basically your teens, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would have spent a lot of time in my teenage years at trawling different record stores, like Tower Records as was, Virgin while it was still there, all of the HMVs, you know, looking for decent music from probably about 5 years beforehand, because, you know, something seemed to have a switch flicked sometime in the late 90s and there wasn't that much great rock music anymore. So if you were looking for kind of alternative stuff, you were looking back a couple of years. And I mean, that song's from an album called University, and I feel like musically it was my university, you know. I love Throwing Muses. I love Kristen Hirsch's voice. I love her kind of strange, surreal, challenging lyrics. I think they're an immensely overlooked band. I mean, the same, you know, they're on 4AD. They have a kind of a Pixies-esque sound. And I just don't know why they didn't make a bigger impact. I mean, I think they have a huge cult following. But I just think that there's a kind of a sophistication
and
at
also,
work there.
I mean, people like Kristen Hirsch, she wasn't the typical woman in a band in those days.
Exactly. And there's a hilarious, I mean, it's not really hilarious, but do you remember The Word? There's a clip of them performing this song and Bright Yellow Gun on The Word with all of the kind of psychedelic effects and the crowd going wild as if it's a Nirvana song, you know, or as if maybe even it's a Pixies song. And it's just deeply inappropriate. It's the wrong reaction. And although the music rocks, it's not kind of moshing music. Yeah. There's something else. And it's just really interesting to look back on that and go, OK, they just heard it's a three chord trick. Let's have everybody go wild in the crowd. And it's just such an incorrect reaction to the music.
And did you respond? I mean, we've had guests on the programme before, women guests who've all said, oh, I remember the first time I saw The Slits, or the first time I saw, you know, naming a band and go, oh, right, OK, that's a different kind of woman. I don't have to be you know, no harm to her, Kylie Minogue, or, you know, who's great. But, you know that more, you know, the pretty lead singer type,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think actually what was really interesting about kind of looking back and looking for those secondhand, you know, grunge tapes and things like that is there was a huge explosion of women in music at that time. So I think coming along a couple of years later and seeing the example of all of these kind of what we call riot girl bands, you know, Babes in Toyland, Bikini Kill, all of those kind of bands, Slater Kinney, who've been around for ages, we forget that they have, you know, is actually, it seemed quite normal. And it seemed to be, what was odd was the fact that after grunge ended, all of the women disappeared. And there were no women in rock anymore, apart from a few kind of notable exceptions. So you were looking back to find out, okay, what's Kristen Hirsch doing now? What's Kathleen Hanna from Bikini Kill doing now? You know, are Slater Kinney going to do another album? So you did have to kind of look back to find those women who were, you know, not necessarily, I mean, some of them, obviously, there was the kind of the whole Babes in Toyland baby doll.
Well, tell me more about that, thing. This riot girl kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it was this notion of women who were, there were lots of women fronted kind of, I mean, it's called grunge, but they were basically punk bands. You know, the musical style was quite similar. You know, they were really angry. I was really angry as a teenager. Now, whether I had anything to be angry about is debatable, as it is for most teenagers. But it was just really cathartic, you know? It was cathartic for me to hear these women being angry about their lives and about various different things that were happening in their lives, from the personal to the really political. And I mean, Bikini Kill in particular were great for that. And I think are one of those bands who are looked back at now and taken a bit more seriously than they maybe were at the time. And some of their music is really prescient. And again, Le Tigre, who were the band that they were, the kind of electro clash version that they had become when I was a teenager, you know, they were a huge kind of political feminist education for me when I was about 16 or 17 and they were releasing their two albums.
So it was an education for you as opposed to, these people are speaking my language, if you know what I mean. You were learning from them.
I was learning from my forebears, you know. And I think, you know, the thing is, it's so easy to see social developments like feminism as something that's kind of happening and improving all of the time, when actually things get better and then they get worse again.
Setbacks,
and then they get slightly better and then they get worse again.
It's an interesting point you made. You're right, a lot of those women who were prominent at that time, they disappeared.
They completely disappeared. Yeah. And whereas, you know, the lead singers from various different male-fronted bands of that time are still afforded cult status, you know, you go on Spotify and you see that Kristen Hirsch maybe has 60,000 listeners a week as opposed to 60 million. You know, it's interesting. And you have somebody, you know, like Tom Waits, who's seen as this wonderful kind of musical survivor and goes through these various iterations of his, you know, his voice becoming more gravelly. And he's just seen as an artist working away. Whereas I think for women artists of the same caliber, there's not quite the same reaction. No offense to Tom Waits, of whom I'm a huge fan as well.
I was about to interject there, but I won't.
Yeah, no we won't. But we won't bash Tom.
But then, to any extent, is that? And again, I know this from people I know. Their audience gets older. The circumstances of their audience changes. Mm-hmm. And suddenly their audience isn't going to gigs anymore. The only person who's still living the same life is the artist.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if Kristen Hirsch isn't being listened to as much as she should be, where are the people who used to listen to her? Where are they?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're probably all still there. And having seen her play most times she comes through Dublin, there is a really loyal crowd. I think it's that the base was never massive to begin with compared to some of their contemporaries, you know, compared to the Pearl Jams or the, you know, the Screaming Trees or the Nirvanas or any of those, you know.
But is that to do with the gender? Is that to do with all the boys who are following Pearl Jam and following? I mean, Pearl Jam, are you, I mean, this, I know this isn't true, but does it break down like this, that the groups who survived were followed by boys and girls, and some of the groups you're talking about are followed by mostly girls?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one. I don't know either. I'll have to do a little pop quiz the next time I'm at a gig like that. But no, I do take your point. I do think, and again, you know, people's lives change, and I am probably much less likely to listen to the angry, shouty punk that really moved me when I was 16.
Yeah, but don't get rid of the record, because the time will come.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so Le Tigre, yeah? Mm-hmm. Get off the internet. Get Off the Internet from Le Tigre. Choice of Jessica Traynor, who's with me in studio tonight. Love that. That's great stuff, isn't it?
Oh, it's brilliant. Yeah. It's brilliant.
So, teenage-wise, we talked about the music, but when did the writing in earnest start? Obviously, you'd done stuff at school and presumably you could knock out an odd good composition and poem to put on the wall and so on.
Yeah,
but you're writing your own thing.
I always wanted to be a writer. I think I wrote a kind of a novel about cats when I was about 6 or 7 years old, which my parents mortifyingly still have. Kind of decided I was going to write my own children's book.
Well, reading some of the novels that get published nowadays, you might as well have a go.
Absolutely.
Set it in Roscommon.
About unspoken sexual tensions between a group of friends
in
who
Roscommon,
are cats who happen to be cats.
In Roscommon.
Somewhere. But I was always very, very keen on it, and I always loved poetry. And I mean, there's one story that I tell, which is kind of funny, but is the truth, which is because we were kind of a family of singers, and my mum has a number of sisters, and a lot of them sang, and my mum sang. So I would always get wheeled out at family parties to sing an adorable version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And I hated it. Yeah. I loved singing in the choir because that felt safe, but I hated singing on my own, and it was nerve-wracking, and I really couldn't stand it. So I remember for my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary, I said, I'm not singing a song, but I'm going to write a poem. And we had been doing...
And what age were you then?
Oh gosh, I'm trying to remember. I was probably about... eight or nine, and we had been doing The Road Not Taken and The Listeners by Walter de la Mare. So I wrote this intensely miserable piece about a man coming back home to the home that he grew up in, which has been abandoned for a very long time, and dropping his suitcase on the dusty floor and the sunshine coming in through the windows and everyone's dead basically, and he's there on his own. And I got up and read it at the party, and nobody ever asked me to perform anything ever again after that. So... So it was poetry as safety blanket.
Know your
you know?
Audience, though.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, no, my granny loved it, and she kept it for years afterwards. But that was kind of my first attempt to write something that was an unrhymed poem, you know, something that kind of emulated the kind of the serious poetry that they're starting to filter in to the curriculum in primary school level.
And when you went to the big school, what sort of poetry anthology, if there was one, were you introduced to?
We had a book, I think it was called Chrysalis. So I didn't have that same experience that everybody had with that. Was it Soundings?
There was one called Soundings, and then the one that we did was called Touchstones.
Okay, yeah.
And it was good too, because it was Ted Hughes and it was Heaney and it was, you know...
Yeah, yeah. It was
the canon, you know?
We had some great stuff. I mean, I loved John Donne.
Yeah.
I just was fascinated kind of coming into, I think we did some John Donne for the, I can't remember whether it was Junior Cert or Leaving Cert or both. I think it might have been both. But I just loved the notion of this kind of allegorical language where you knew it was like a secret code. There was something going on the surface which sounded amazing, but everything had its specific web of meanings. And it was like learning an entirely new language. And that really fascinated me. And something about that kind of conceptual nature of poetry has always stuck with me. Whether it's in the work, my own work, I'm not sure, but I've always admired that kind of cleverness.
I'd imagine people who devise a curriculum for school kids will be always looking for, I don't know, plain language or street language or something like that. And yet you're responding to something written a long, long time ago by kind of a strange man.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was certainly there. And I also suppose it was mirrored in the Shakespeare that we were doing in a way, you know, and the work we were having to do to understand that. But then we also did Elizabeth Bishop, Sylvia Plath. They were two that really stood out for me. And neither of those are easy poets, you know. And we had a really, really good teacher who just went into it in great depth. You know, there was a lot of work done on meaning. And I think as well, you know, I think that can kind of shut the idea of the poem down sometimes. But if you're the kind of person who enjoys that kind of meticulous looking at each little, I suppose, building block of the language, I really loved that, you know.
And what about this idea, though, that sometimes where school can go wrong with poetry is a poem is always presented as a puzzle that you have to solve.
Yes.
And it's not necessarily that, you know.
Yes.
I don't know what it means. Well, okay, That's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the problem comes if somebody says, my take on the poem is this, and if somebody then comes and says, it's not what it is. And I think that does happen sometimes.
Yes.
And I also think that, you know, where I really responded well to the John Donne and the Elizabeth Bishop and the Sylvia Plath, I don't think we did any contemporary poets who are out living, working. Right. I think that's changed a little bit. I mean, I see it among my peers the odd time somebody says, oh, my poem's on the junior cert curriculum. The poets are delighted by that.
Yeah.
And I think that the children respond well to that work as well. And because it demystifies the entire thing. I mean, if you're only learning from people who are dead.
Of course.
It sends a certain message.
Yeah, I know when my kids were doing Paul Durkin and Heaney, obviously, but other people who were
absolutely
around the place.
And people who are likely to be able to come to your school, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, I mean, you know, Paul Durkin and Heaney, wonderful, but very hard to get them to come to, you know, St. Louis National School in Rathmines.
But even the fact they're writing about a place that you know, or, you know, they're writing about your own street or your own home or your own hometown or whatever. But in terms of your own writing, it's a curious thing though. With teachers, a teacher will ask you to write something, and if you can write it all, inevitably you can turn something out. You know, it's a strange thing. You know, I want you to write an essay about the following, or write a poem about the following, and you do it, which is kind of contrary to the whole notion of what creativity is about. You know, you're supposed to sit around and wait for inspiration.
Well, and I think this is that's a really interesting thing to say, I think, because one of the things I've been thinking about recently is the notion of creativity and how we apply it to various different things. And what is creativity? It's problem solving.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, with a poem, I want to communicate this. How do I get there through language? And that's a problem to be solved in a way. And I think that often we put creativity in this box as something mysterious. We wait for the visit of the muse. Whereas if I'm wording a tricky email, I have to be as clever and as creative as I do in writing a poem a lot of the time. And again, I'm just so keen on the demystification of all of this, because I think the feeling that you get when you write a poem is something akin to the mystic. You know, you do feel like you are bringing together various different forces and ideas in a way that you may not completely understand. But at the same time, as I've gone on as a writer and two collections in now, I know when my mind is at its most fertile to receive ideas, and I know what kind of building blocks, various different juxtapositions and contrasts I'm going to create.
Well, let's talk about that in some more detail after this next track, because that's big stuff you're getting into now. Very early in the night. It's early in the night for that, but we'll do it. I'll follow you. Smashing Pumpkins. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're still a fan?
You know, I think Billy Corgan has written some absolutely wonderful songs. I wish he'd stop now. but I think that these tracks were just perfect kind of...
Well, surprise, surprise. We have Billy Corgan right here in studio.
Oh, no.
Smashing Pumpkins tonight. The choice of Jessica Traynor, who's with me in studio tonight. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more music from Jessica. Don't go away. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. My guest tonight, Jessica Traynor. She's picking all the music tonight. And this is PJ Harvey. PJ Harvey there and Dress. Jessica Traynor is with me in studio tonight picking all the tunes. Jessica's a writer, poet, dramaturg, and we'll talk about that shortly too, and creative writing teacher. And just before the break, Jessica, you were just getting into the whole idea of creativity and whether it's the muse coming in the window, or sitting down and getting on with it.
Yeah, I think it's, I really think it's sitting down and getting on with it. And without that, the muse doesn't appear. But I think the muse is an internal thing.
Yeah.
And the muse is that kind of magic that happens when you juxtapose and contrast ideas and language in a way that surprises you and that helps you get at something that's your kind of, I suppose, your own inner truth and your inner message that all of us are struggling to articulate day to day in the world, whether it's, you know, trying to buy a cup of coffee or communicate with somebody who's angry with you. Language is this massive flawed system that we're all trying to negotiate throughout our lives. And if there are moments when we can knit it together into something beautiful, then wonderful. But, you know, the onus is on all of us as individuals to make it happen. And I've come across so many young writers who have become disappointed because either everybody else makes it look very easy, or they're waiting for the perfect atmosphere, or they're waiting for the perfect job to come along to allow them 12 hours a day to write, you know. And like, none of these things exist, but also that's okay, you know. And you can be somebody who works full time in a clothes shop, or, you know, behind a desk answering emails, and is also a writer. But you kind of, the only person who's owed anything, you owe it to yourself, you know, to make the time for that kind of thing to happen.
And in your case, what prompts you to write poetry? Say, let's concentrate on the poetry for now. What prompts you to write that, as opposed to dealing with the world and your inner truth and all the rest of it in some other way?
It's funny. I think I've always been kind of under the spell of what poetry can do and how it can, I suppose, communicate those deeper truths in such small amounts of language. And also, for me, poetry is hugely about trying to figure out the world. I mean, I think my subconscious is working away all the time, trying to figure out on a kind of a basic level what's going on, you know, whether it's in the news or in my personal life or in my work life. I think all of us have this kind of subconscious process going on. And sometimes that will throw you insights. And sometimes those insights will be something to build a poem around. And whether it's maybe thinking of an image or a line that comes to you like a snatch of music almost, putting it down somewhere and seeing what grows around it. But that process has always been immensely pleasurable for me. Mm. I've enjoyed it.
So it's a pleasure?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, when it happens.
Yeah. Of course, when it's not happening, it could be a torment and a torture.
Yeah.
Which you could do without because you're busy with other things.
Absolutely. And I really do try to... You know, people talk again, I think talk about writer's block is almost as damaging as talk about the muse, because it's personifying these two things, this negative external thing and this positive external thing, and pitting them against you, the helpless individual. The writer's block and the muse both live inside you. Mm. And the writer's block is your phone. It's Facebook, it's Twitter, it's your shopping list, it's your electricity bill. It's all of the various different things that can eat up a huge amount of your life and your mental space without you realising it. And I just kind of made a little bargain with myself, probably well before the first book came out, that if I found myself feeling that stress and that anxiety, that I would make some time to allow myself to be kind of open to the world around me. And for me, actually, a lot of that is listening to music, whether it's, okay, I've got a long bus journey, I'm not going to take out the laptop. Everybody can wait. I'm going to put on my headphones and look out the window and daydream. And often that's when poetry will come to me, or even the idea for a poem. You know, earlier on, I was in a cafe ordering a coffee and the waitress saw I had my laptop there and she said, oh, the password is cauliflower with a capital C. And I kind of sat there thinking, cauliflower, what an interesting word. You know, cauliflower, does that come from call, like a child's call? Mm. And I immediately sent myself a little email saying, cauliflower, look up etymology. And when you see the baby poem about cauliflowers, you'll know where it's come from. But if I didn't make a conscious decision to be receptive to all those little digressions, even to the extent of just putting them in a little note to self on the phone.
And if you don't put them in a note, are they gone?
Oh, I think they're gone. Mm. Yeah. I think they are. I think it's really important. And sometimes you look back over them and you go, what the hell was I thinking about? Cauliflower? Mm. What is that? Mm-hmm. Or nothing comes of it. But if you don't try and catch them.
Well, it's been said before that a lot of what poets do in particular is they're basically just people who pay attention.
Yeah.
You know,
they
notice what's going on
Absolutely.
Around them.
Absolutely. But you have to allow yourself to notice.
Yeah.
And I think we're all paying attention, but we are filtering it out a lot of information that comes to us as unnecessary.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when I say this, when I'm teaching creative writing, I kind of give a similar spiel to the one we've been discussing, because I do believe it to be true. But you know, if you do try and open yourself to that experience and pay more attention, you won't immediately come up with something. But much like, you know, if you go to the gym 3 times a week or if you practice playing the piano, you will see improvements.
Yeah.
It won't happen overnight.
Well, say I was in your class now and I said to you, yeah, that's all fine, but you know, Australia's in flames and the world's a mess, and you know, our leaders are all, you know, I mean, the world's just tanked.
Mm-hmm.
And you're writing about cauliflowers. Do you know what I mean?
I know. Yeah.
What use is writing poetry in the face of, you know, the real stuff?
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And whether it's Wordsworth writing about daffodils or whatever it is, you know,
yeah.
I mean, what good is it going to do anybody but yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think as readers of poetry, we have to admit that it does us good and it is a solace for us,
mm-hmm.
or it is something we turn to in terms of trying to work out these problems, partly because I think it's good for us as human beings to aim for something better.
Mm-hmm.
And even if that only affects us on a psychological level, and even if my baby poem called Cauliflowers about me and my daughter, even if that only lifts the spirits of another person who's had a similar experience, you know, I think that's enough.
Yeah.
You know, it's not enough, full stop, our duty is over. But, you know, the world is a dark place and you can't let it get to you, because if you let it get to you, then you'll be paralysed. And even the tiny, small differences you were making will cease to happen. And that would be tragic, I think.
I think Heaney said once that poetry was a stay against confusion.
Absolutely.
You know, it is that.
Yeah.
Does steadies things.
Yeah.
Which is why, I mean, I've said this to people so many times, they're fed up hearing me say it, but, you know, that's why people read poems at weddings and at funerals and things like that. You know, it's the only way of expressing what needs to be expressed.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't do it yourself, but some other person was able to do it, so
yeah,
there you
yeah.
go. Anyway, lyrics I wanted to ask you about, and I haven't yet. We just played PJ Harvey.
Mm.
You would pay close attention, I'd say, to what she says.
Yes, I do. And I actually, one of the reasons I love that song is the kind of the interesting, sophisticated gender politics of it.
Yeah.
You know, this notion of putting on a dress and what that means and who has the power there. Is it, you know, woman as recipient of the male gaze, or woman as arbiter of their own sexuality? And it reminds me of that Kim Adonisio poem, What Women Want, you know, about the red dress. And yeah, lyrics are so important.
That's a poem does the rounds on social media quite a bit.
It does, it yeah. does, yeah, absolutely.
And that's again what we're saying. I mean, she wouldn't have thought when she wrote that poem that people would be paying, who don't never read poetry, would be paying close attention to that.
Exactly, yeah. And it's anything that gets towards that kind of shared lived experience and those little puzzles in our lives and those little contradictions, like the power of a red dress. You know, is it power? Whose power is it? And that's always been really important to me in terms of lyrics. I want something that challenges me. You know, I'm definitely a big fan of lyrics, and I would have spent a lot of time kind of reading them and writing them out when I was growing up.
And do you think, you know, when I think of Heaney's generation, they weren't affected, certainly Seamus wasn't, by popular culture at all. You know, I mean, he would have been aware of Paul Simon and Bob Dylan and so on, but wasn't really, you know, from that
era.
Whereas someone like Muldoon clearly is.
Yes.
And anybody younger. Do you think that the poets nowadays, from Muldoon's age on, would have been quite influenced by pop music in particular and lyrics of the, you know, Dylan and the obvious people, Leonard Cohen and so on?
Yeah, I think so. I think when they allow themselves to be, or when they find ways of kind of marrying that influence with their own originality, you know, and I think especially the younger generation, I mean, the poets who are kind of coming after me, the poets who are in their mid-20s now, it's
yeah.
all about internet culture
mm-hmm.
and reference. And that's really interesting as well,
yeah.
because the internet is a fascinating collage of different influences.
And what about those of us, you know, who would have been aware of hip-hop growing up and rap and all the rest of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's a huge influence on the spoken word scene,
mm.
you know. And again, kind of growing up as somebody who was listening to music in the late 90s, early 2000s, I would have listened to a lot of hip-hop as well and really enjoyed that. You know, and you definitely see those influences coming through in a lot of spoken word poetry, which has that kind of immediacy and the ability to react to contemporary situations that other lyric poetry or page poetry, I suppose, might not have. But I think that poetry is flexible enough to contain all of those multitudes.
I get asked a lot what I think of performance poetry.
Oh, yes. You know? Yeah, yeah.
And while a lot of it wouldn't be my bag, it's still good.
It is still good. And I mean, I find it, like, I call it a gateway drug, yeah. You know? And especially the same, probably more so with Instagram poetry, these poets who are kind of little picture and kind of what's more like an inspirational quote. But, you know, it's like, come for the Instagram poetry and then stay for the people who have been working at it for years. But even if one person then, you know, goes on to the harder stuff, that's surely a good thing.
The Great Spelunker is your next choice, Masters of Reality.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't see that coming.
Yeah, yeah. I spent a lot of... I was a kind of a teenage music nerd, as you probably know from my kind of rifling through various different charity shop music bins and things like that. And there was this kind of scene from the mid to late 90s in America, this desert rock stoner rock scene, who were kind of the inheritors of grunge and kind of turned into bands like Queens of the Stone Age, yeah. Who would be kind of a big noise in alternative rock at the moment and for the past decade. But this band, Masters of Reality, obviously named after the Sabbath album, this producer, Chris Goss, would have worked with a huge number of these kind of mid-90s grunge bands and afterwards, and really kind of, again, was one of these underappreciated people who created this entire scene and a sound. But, you know, this song in particular is very kind of Pink Floyd-esque. It has this kind of dreamy, groovy sound to it, which I really enjoy. But yeah, I don't know if anybody else in Dublin or Ireland has ever really listened to them.
Well, they will now. Masters of Reality there, the choice of Jessica Traynor, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. Your first book, Jessica, with Daedalus Press, was called Liffey Swim. Very fine book, if I may say so. And there's since been another one. The Quick. What was the gap between the two of them? Apart from haircuts, I noticed.
Yeah, apart from haircuts. Yeah. One of my many wigs that I'm changing all the time. But no, it was about 4 years. Yeah, so 4 years worth of hair growth in between the first and the second.
Now, when you did the first one, again, you think of bands and their first album and things like that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the best thing they ever did. And sometimes it's like, that's all right. But it's a step on, you know, they're off and running now. You know,
yes.
How did you kind of feel about it? Well, how do you feel about it now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think I'm still delighted with it and proud of it. But I remember Pat Boren, my editor, saying to me, you know, beware of throwing the kitchen sink at the book, yeah. Which is something that young poets tend to do, you know. And because with your first book, you're always gathering up about 10 or 15 years of experience.
Yeah.
With the second book, you're having to kind of react quicker.
What's happened in the last 6 months?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So generally speaking, things become more thematically coherent, hopefully, as the books progress.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I look back on it and I think I was still probably finding my, you know, my voice, doing bunny ears here, you know, what does voice mean? But I was still kind of identifying my preoccupations. There are a lot of poems I'm really proud of in it and that I look back and I go, God, I don't know how I wrote that, which I think is always the mark of a poem that, maybe not a great poem, but a poem that the writer is still in love with a bit, where you kind of go, God, I'm not sure exactly where that one came
from.
Yeah,
but you've already talked about your suspicions about the existence of the muse and so on,
yeah,
and so forth.
Yeah.
When you are in that situation where you go, what was I thinking of? What? Well, then what was happening then? I mean, there must be something mystical happening.
Well, I think that for me, it's like, I always think of it like the poetry is kind of like the cross or a crossword. You know, there is a logic to it, but it's an intensely lateral logic.
Right.
You know, it might not be moving forward or backwards. It might be moving sideways and diagonally.
Mm-hmm.
So your kind of free associations in your mind are happening, are sparking off at a number of different levels and directions. And you're wrestling that into a shape,
right,
for the reader. So it's definitely a kind of a familiar thought process to a certain degree, but it's harder to explain, I think.
But when you look at a poem and you go, I don't remember writing that and I don't even know what I was thinking or where that came from or anything.
I'll probably have more of a sense. I'll always have a sense of the intention,
right,
you know, of what I was trying to convey. But that intention could just be a feeling. an atmosphere. And the way that I've then illustrated that feels quite, that's the part of it that I think, well, that's where the real inspiration was, you know, that I chose this particular fable-like situation or narrative in order to communicate that attention. That's the kind of the interesting bit that I sometimes go, oh, I don't know how I came up with that.
And how did you find then when you produced the books and you're out on the road and you're reading them to small groups of people?
Well, you know what? Sometimes
large groups of people. Sometimes.
With the first book, I would have been a much more nervous reader. And then I went to lots of festivals and I watched lots of other people. And I watched especially lots of women poets being really apologetic about their work.
Yeah.
And I thought, come on, Jess, you have a theatre background. You know better than this. If you go out and apologise, people will think you've something to be sorry for.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really basic psychology. But if you go out there and just say this is happening now and you're going to enjoy it, people will think they've had a great time. So
the poems will continue until morale improves.
Exactly. Yeah. So I've enjoyed kind of finding a slightly more performative voice in the second book, and a lot of that came from the kind of the poems that I would read from the first book that went down very well, where I gave a little bit more of a performance. Now, I would never call myself a performance poet, but I think I've gotten more comfortable in my own voice.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that people get more comfortable in their own skin. And I think that that has helped with the work. I think it's helped me feel more confident in the work that I'm writing and also in my delivery of it. And that means I'm having more fun. So hopefully the audience is too.
And in terms of your sense of yourself as a writer, when you're a poet, you know, basically what happens is, you know, the book comes out and if you're lucky, some people will buy it and you'll read at some events and that kind of thing. But it's not you're not going to have the same experience that other writers that you'll find all over Twitter are having.
Mm-hmm.
People who write prose or write nonfiction. People who are successful in an arena where it's actually possible to be successful.
Yeah.
Are you happy in that swim of being in poetry as opposed to people you would know who are, you know, by the looks of things, are doing extremely well?
I'm not sure who you're talking about, John. Is there anyone doing better than me at the moment?
novelists and so on.
Yes.
Oh, that's just the hot new thing from Ireland and blah, blah, short story writers from Roscommon and all. There's so many of them
exactly.
now. And if you read their Twitter accounts, you would think that they were all really living on the hog now.
But do you know what, John? I get people saying the same thing to me.
Yeah.
You know, God, you're doing so well. And then I'm just out there kind of going, you have to keep spreading the word about the work. And it does make us all feel that everybody else is doing so much better. But I think that's more to do with the kind of the echo chamber of social media.
But poetry is quieter though, isn't it?
It's
a quieter world.
And I have to say that does suit me. You know, I never thought that I was going to be reading to, you know, the audience at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
You know, it was never going to be that kind of career. But I think that kind of suits me, you know?
Yeah.
I enjoy it.
I think it's a healthier swim to be in.
Yes.
Although I'm sure the poetry world can have its, I'm sure there's intrigue and all the rest of it going
on there
too.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful dynamic, which is an actual kind of recognised dynamic called, I think it's called Sales Law, which was initially coined, the term was coined for academia. And the dynamic of Sales Law is that the smaller, the lower the stakes, the more angry and involved people get.
Oh.
Yeah. And that is definitely the case in the poetry world sometimes. People, a very small piece of the pie to be passed around in terms of arts funding and things like that in the poetry world, but boy do people fight for it tooth
and
nail.
I think a lot of writing, contemporary writing, prose writing, novels and so on, you know that those writers have been affected by the possibility that it could be very successful for them because somebody else they know has been successful last year or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of changed the way people write. They're writing with the possibility of huge success hanging over them.
Yes.
Whereas if you're writing poetry, that's not going to happen.
No, it's not.
So I think you've got a clearer run at what you're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it is more about the notion, and it's a kind of an innocent notion in a way, that you are showing something deeply personal and sharing that with an audience, which is less the case. I mean, obviously, of course, every writer is completely part of the work that they make. But poetry, it is a more personal and direct conversation.
But it's definitely not a career move.
No, it certainly isn't.
Whereas, you know, any young person who writes a novel nowadays, it is potentially a career move.
Potentially. Although, you know, I think in a lot of those cases, the sales are not quite what everyone would hope, you know, and I think it's probably harder than people make it look.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
the book you produced with Stephen Ray, tell me a bit about that and where that came from.
So this came from, I suppose I worked in the Abbey for about 10 years, so I would have known Stephen a bit from my time working in the literary department there. And he knew I was a poet. He knew I had written some poems that responded to the situation of direct provision. And in 2017, he asked me to be part of this Field Day Right to Have Rights lecture series that Seamus Dean and a few others were speaking at, and Judge Brian McMahon. And there were a number of people as well, different artists who were in direct provision who had come to contribute to the lectures as well. And I mean, it was such a positive experience that we really wanted to see what we could do to keep the conversation going. So myself and Stephen and Billy Hall, who's out at UCD, kind of tried to figure out what we could do by way of an arts anthology, you know. And it comes back to the question of what does art change? Mm-hmm. You know, are we going to change hearts and minds here with this? What are we going to do? So we really thought we might try and focus in on creating a kind of an experience or the potential for an experience for people in direct provision that they might not get otherwise, which was to ask them to contribute work if they'd liked the anthology on no set theme. We didn't ask them to talk about why they had come to Ireland or what their experience was in direct provision. Now, most of them chose to kind of respond in either broadly and under either of those two categories. But, you know, we thought, OK, we'll get these contributions in and then we'll say to the people, would you like to be paired with an Irish writer for a little bit of mentorship, to develop a piece in tandem with each other, and then we'll publish you side by side and then in the anthology. And we also had got funding so everyone would be paid for this process. So lots of people kind of took that up. And what we were trying to do, I suppose, was to create a relationship outside of the direct provision system for people who are based here in these incredibly geographically isolated centres in many cases, who are kind of stuck there waiting for their applications to go through for years in some cases, to allow them to kind of connect a little bit with people in Irish society and to allow people in Irish society to connect with them, for this cultural exchange that we kind of hoped would outlast the book itself. You know, anthologies are ephemeral things, they come and go. And we also then, we got lots of submissions in after the deadline had closed. So in those cases, we asked an Irish artist to respond to those pieces. So there's lots of pairings in the book and lots of friendships that have continued on afterwards.
Yeah, it seems to have been, it got a lot of coverage. The book's been reprinted now a couple.
Yes, yeah. We've gone to reprint. We've lots of events lined up between now and the summertime, at which various contributors will be reading. So we're going to have one at the Ennis Book Club Festival. There's one in Refugee Week in Cork, the first week in February. And there's a lot of other ones in the works as well.
And it's published by Stinging Fly, isn't it?
It's actually not. No, we published it ourselves. We wanted to respond very quickly. And as you know yourself, most publishers will be kind of saying, oh, we'd love to do this project, but it'll be 2020, 2021 by the time we can fit it into our publishing schedule. So I just got advice from various different people, including the Stinging Fly, who are publishing books. And we published it ourselves with our own funding. But the Stinging Fly were generous enough to help us with the online distribution, because we were all things to all men and women. We were, you know, the editors, we were the account holders. We were the people who were typesetting and publishing the book and distributing it then. So,
and it's called
Correspondences.
Correspondences. And it's got a great cover on it as well.
It's a wonderful cover. And we had so many generous people involved, including Fintan Wall, a graphic designer who I've worked with a couple of times through my work in Epic, the Irish Emigration Museum, for the past couple of years. But he feels very passionately about the subject as well. So he did the cover.
All
good bookshops, yeah.
Okay, so your next choice, let's get a few more of these in. Agnes Obel.
Yes,
Spooky song.
I love the teenage goth in me, still alive and kicking.
And this is called Familiar. And that's Agnes Obel there, and Familiar, the choice of Jessica Traynor, who's with me in studio tonight. We've been talking a lot tonight about Jessica's work as a poet, but also on your CV, you're a dramaturg. Now, I think I've met a dramaturg before, and I asked the same question. what's a dramaturg?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to put it is you're a script editor.
Yeah.
So you're working
for the theatre.
Yes, for the theatre. And you're working with playwrights who are developing their plays, much in the same way that a poetry editor or a novel editor would work. Generally speaking, with plays, you're going to be doing a few kind of workshops where you'll bring a director, some actors in, and they'll kind of play around with the piece. So it's kind of a slightly more high impact role than the very kind of intimate role between a prose editor and a prose writer.
And at what stages of the process are you present? Are you at work?
Well, I would have, when I was in the Abbey commissioning plays, I would have read every draft of the play as it came in. Mm-hmm. And I think myself and the playwright would kind of mutually agree when was the time to workshop it. And then, you know, there might be instances where you'd say this needs a one day sit down workshop, very quiet, or it needs a week long workshop where it's up on its feet and we're trying out different things and we're looking at different aspects of the text and its presentation. So that's an interesting role.
So it's very heavily involved in the production.
Absolutely, yeah.
I used to think it was kind of like you were like the lawyer, that they kind of sent you the script at the end and you went just ticked things and question marks here and there.
It's more like carving out a pumpkin and taking out all of the seeds and things like that. It's a much messier, more involved process. But there's also the kind of the more traditional dramaturg role, which is also just around things like fact checking a play, looking at the various different historical contexts of something like Shakespeare, bringing in information about various different productions. American dramaturgy can be quite focused on that, looking at the history of the productions of a piece in its various contexts. So there's that as well.
And it's good. That can be somebody's job, that it's a time-consuming thing. Somebody else is doing that.
Yeah. And it was a fascinating, wonderful experience working with playwrights.
What years were you there then? I'm thinking of the playwrights you would have worked with.
So I was in the Abbey from 2007 to 2017.
Oh, well.
So in various, I was literary manager for the last 2 years of that. Before that, I would have been kind of in slightly lesser roles of support, but would have done a lot of work directly with playwrights as well. Mostly had been in all of the workshops, offering my opinions. But for the last 2 years, I was kind of there at every single stage.
Well, would you work with Tom Murphy, for instance?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I used to. I had known Tom actually since I was very young, because Jane Brennan, his partner's mother, Daphne, lived on the same road we lived on in Rathgar.
Right. Yeah.
And then also when my parents split up, me and my mum bought the bottom part of Tom Murphy's house Rathgar.
Yeah, I know that house.
You know it, yeah. So we almost bought the basement, and we didn't. We didn't then in the end. We went to Churchtown instead. But I've kind of known him since I was very young.
But what happens, for instance, if it's a Tom Murphy play and it's not a new play? Is there a role for you in that? I mean, the play has already been done. It's flawless.
Well, flawless, yeah. Yes. Is anything ever flawless? Yeah. The director might disagree with that, you know. So often it would depend on the kind of production it was. With a piece of work that's existing, if the director wants to take a different approach and wants to look at it and maybe cut things, and if the writer is very happy with that, then yeah, there would have been a role for me there. But a lot of the time the writer, and rightly so, would be quite protective of the text, and not want any changes to be made. So, but it could... Any different kind of situation could play out depending on the kind of production, the writer, the director, all of those different things. But I would have worked
Brian Friel?
With Brian, I would have done less dramaturgical work. I'm trying to think if we did anything.
I wouldn't have fancied ringing up Brian and saying we need to move Act Two and shift it to.
No. And I mean, the one thing that I worked on quite a lot with Tom Murphy, for example, was The Last Days of a Reluctant Tyrant.
That was a great.
Which was a great big epic piece. But that was more about kind of aiding him with his own process, which was very unique. Mm. So he wrote everything by hand. And what he would do is he would rewrite scenes from memory. If something wasn't working, he'd take it away and he'd kind of rewrite the scene from memory. And generally what happened was the good stuff stuck and the unnecessary stuff fell out.
Right.
And that was his process. And I would give him my opinions, but there were some playwrights who really wanted you in there from the outset and other playwrights who would come to you and, ask you whether things were working, and then you could say, well, I'm just going to venture that perhaps this scene, is not quite working
venture.
In this position. But you had to build those relationships with care.
Oh, yeah. I'll bet. It's a tricky thing, but it's necessary.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Absolutely.
I've just said it's necessary, but do all theatres have a dramaturg?
No, not all of them have the luxury. Yeah. You know, I mean, there are a number of theatre companies in Ireland who have dramaturgical positions. You know, Druid and Rough Magic have traditionally had them. Fish Amble obviously has Gavin Costick, and then Tinderbox in the North, I don't think they have their dramaturg anymore. So often, in my case, I was the literary manager, which meant that I did the dramaturgical work, but I also commissioned the plays. I also licensed plays.
Were you in the Abbey when Sam Shepherd was here?
Yes, yeah, yeah. I would have been there for Kicking a Dead Horse and Ages of the Moon as well.
Sam sitting up the back laughing.
Oh yeah, exactly, exactly. And going out for sessions in the cobblestone afterwards with all of the trad musicians. Oh, we had great fun.
And me bending his ear about Bob Dylan all the time.
I'm sure he didn't mind.
No, he didn't. Bless him. More music. Chelsea, Mark Lanigan, you really want to hear.
I'd love to get Mark in. Yeah.
All right. You're a huge fan of Mark.
I am.
And you're not wrong. You're quite right. He's one of the best, I think. Here it comes. Resurrection Song. Okay. Lanigan. Jessica Traynor with me in studio. You're a huge Mark Lanigan fan, actually.
I am a really big Mark Lanigan fan. Myself and my husband tend to try and go and see him whenever he comes through town, which is about every year and a half. Yeah. And it's just been a couple of markers in my life. And we lived in Edinburgh for a little while and we had absolutely no money. And around 2011. And the one thing we did while we were there for the 9 months or so was we went to Glasgow to see Mark Lanigan. And we've seen him now twice or three times since then. And I remember that one of the first gig I went to, and I love going to gigs, I go to them as often as I can, after I gave birth, I think in September, was Mark Lanigan in December of 2017. And it was just kind of a nice returning to, you know, my own life as well as the life of mother and child. Yes, I can still go to gigs.
Never regret going to a gig.
No, never, never.
Even a bad one, there's something good happens.
Oh, just really good for the soul. I love it.
Now, I was going to ask you about lyrics and writing lyrics yourself, but you were at work on a libretto, weren't you?
I am, yeah. Really interesting project.
Am I supposed to know that? Sorry. The look on your face was like, oh, can I talk about this?
Oh, yeah. No, of course I can, absolutely. It's a commission from Music for Galway and Galway 2020 to write a libretto for a community opera that's going to happen in St. Nicholas's Church in the heart of Galway in June of this year now, 2020, and INO, Irish National Opera, are co-producing it. And I'm working with a choral composer called Elaine Agnew, whose music I would have known from singing in choirs myself, and who I worked with on a lovely song cycle project that was commissioned by Poetry Ireland and Chamber Choir Ireland last year. So this project came up incredibly ambitious. They said, will you write a libretto for us? And I thought to myself, oh my God, I have no idea how to write a libretto. But as a freelance writer, I had to say, yes, of course.
Of course I know how to write it.
Of course. And, you know, I will try it. And if 2 weeks down the line, I realise I really can't, I will let them.
Well, you know, you're not the first person, the first guest I've had here. They've been musicians mostly, but they've said things from a pop music, rock music background, and they said, oh yeah, I've been asked to write an opera, work on an opera. And I've said to them, what do you know about opera? And they say, nothing.
But
when you write a libretto, maybe it's different in every context, but I can't imagine you can just send them loads of words and you go off, you go, you work with that. You must collaborate closely, do you?
Well, I had confidence that I had from my own theatrical background and my own work with playwrights and my own previous work with Elaine, and then having seen a lot of opera over the course of my working life, I kind of knew I had a sense of what I was aiming for.
Yeah.
I also had a sense of, you know, I had a chorus of a certain number of people. I had a certain number of solo singers, and then there was a bigger community chorus. So all of these things were putting little parameters in that I thought, okay, these are the things I can work within.
Okay.
I would love to know more about opera. I would have loved to have known more about music going into it. But I knew, because Elaine is the composer and she's worked with my poetry before, I knew that she would be able, that that what I write would suit her style of composition.
Yeah.
So I wrote the first draft of it and sent it off and expected there to be a huge amount of back and forth, but they were actually very happy with what I'd done. So obviously it's developed since then, but I was expecting them to say, my goodness, this is not what we wanted at all. But everybody's very
and
happy.
And you just said,
it.
Fair enough, because they don't know what I'm doing.
Well, exactly. Yeah. But I would have been very happy to kind of try other things. But, you know, we're kind of steaming ahead. We had a lovely launch there back towards the end of last year in Galway, where one of our wonderful opera singers sang a section of it that Elaine has composed.
That must feel very strange.
Strange and just wonderful, really wonderful. So it's been one of the most exciting things I think that I've done in my professional career. And I'm glad I said yes.
Yes, we're going to play your second last track here, Run the Jewels.
Yes. Yeah, I love.
Is it anything like what you're writing for the opera?
It is not.
Oh. Oh, yeah, I think that might have been the clean version, actually. Run the Jewels and early the
Very hard to find a clean version of most of their songs. I did try.
Well, I think on Lyric FM we excel at finding the clean version. Yeah. Opera can be as violent
debauched
as possible, but any other kind of music has to be censored. Run the Jewels, early the choice of Jessica Traynor, who's with me in studio. Now, Jessica's correspondence is a book she edited with Stephen Ray. Correspondence is available now in all good bookshops. It's all in a good cause too. Her own books, the first one, The Liffey Swim, and then that was followed by The Quick, are on Daedalus Press. Mm-hmm. There'll be another one, I'm sure, coming along soon.
We hope so.
And I just wanted to ask you one more question before we go, because a lot of people that listen to the show, you find people who'd like to write themselves and try to write and so on. Where do you write, and in what circumstances do you write? If you have a choice, sometimes you may be on the bus, I know, but how do you normally do it?
I have to say, and this is against all the rules, but generally it's curled up on the sofa with my laptop on my lap, with my husband sitting beside me watching sports or current affairs programs, or, you know, I might be half watching something and I'll be working away. I like to be in the middle of things.
You know?
I do. Yeah. Now, if I'm doing a long editing project, you know, if I'm getting a book together, I will try and get away to a writer's retreat. We've just moved house and hopefully at some stage I will have a study space in that house, but I can still see myself taking the laptop and coming back into the living room.
You won't have a study space.
I won't. Children, have a toy room.
Children will put a stop to that. But that's interesting that you can write in the middle. Yeah, I can understand you writing maybe in a noisy pub or something, but not in your own house.
Well, you know, I just like the companionship. You know, I'm one of these kind of introvert extrovert people. Like I like to be away from the big crowds, but I like to be with my people.
Yeah.
And you know, I would either be reading or writing. Declan might be reading or writing. You know, Abigail is too young to be, you know, up past 7:30. Yes. So maybe that'll change in the next couple of years. But I just, because all of us have so much full-time work to do, I would be very loath to give up even that sitting in the same space in the evening. And I'm just really good at kind of filtering out those distractions.
And the television could be on.
Yeah. The television could be on. Yeah, I can just ignore it.
And you mentioned Declan a couple of times there, and would you say, what do you think of this? I've just written this.
I will sometimes, if I'm really up against it and I need to present something in public and nobody else has time, I will prevail upon him. Right. And he's very good about that kind of thing. But I try not to too much. I try to choose the ones that I'm going to inflict on him and ask for an opinion.
Because one of the first things you said about, you talked about being a writer, it's an isolated scenario. It is by its nature. You have to do it yourself. The isolation is, it's good and bad, isn't it, really?
I think so, yeah. I think most writers need a certain degree of isolation. You know, there's that kind of needing to recharge the batteries thing that goes on. But I also think that being around other people is where your inspiration comes from. You know, that's so important to find some sort of balance between the two. And that's why I don't think I could ever be a full-time poet. I think if the inspiration for a novel or something else long form ever comes along, the luxury of having, you know, 8 hours a day to work on that sounds wonderful. But I that wouldn't work for me poetry-wise, apart from, again, as I said, those intense periods of editing when you're working very clearly towards a deadline for a book.
And what about with poetry, strike rate? You know, there are a lot of novelists who seem to be able, if they put their mind to it, they sit down and write a novel. It's a version of another novel or a version of one they've written themselves. But with poetry, I mean, would you write, you know, would one in every 10 turn out to be a poem, or would every second one have some promise to it, or what?
You know, it's really hard. I never make those decisions until the book is happening, and then I think it becomes very clear which are the successful and not successful ones. I mean, taking them out on and reading them in public is also a good thing, as long as you're not, you know, doing the whole kind of Bob Dylan thing of making everybody listen to the entirety, or Leonard or Neil Young, of making everyone listen to the recent stuff. There is a balance there, but yeah, I think I try not to make those decisions until I'm looking at gathering something into a coherent project. And then there may be poems that are really good poems. And oddly, sometimes those are the poems that win competitions. And I often find if you look at a collection of poetry and there's a competition winning poem in the middle of it, it's often the one that sticks out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
Because it's a wonderful little kind of microcosm in and of itself, but it doesn't fit anywhere else.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually speak to any of the other poems in the book. So that's a weird challenge, I think.
And you would rely heavily on the advice of editors and first readers and all the rest of it.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm lucky enough with Pat. He's a great editor. You know, he has a really good eye on things, and we can kind of talk back and forth about things. But I will also send work to my peers, other poets who I really respect, and I will prevail upon them, because just to have a kind of a couple of different reactions, you know, and they may not all be right, or they may not be right for you. But I think part of becoming a confident writer is filtering out the advice that may be well-meaning but actually is not speaking to your intentions as a writer, and then also accepting the advice that you want to reject because you're afraid that you don't know how to implement it. That's the real trick, living with the stuff that terrifies you, when your own reaction as a maybe an intelligent or articulate person is to say, no, that's not a problem, and here are the 7 reasons why. And as a dramaturg, I would see playwrights doing this a lot, especially the younger ones. They would kind of say, no, that's not a problem, and here are the 7 reasons. And you'd kind of say to yourself, I think you're just afraid you don't know how to fix the problem. But nobody's asking you to fix the problem right now.
Yeah.
We're just saying, let's say that it's a problem and we can live with it for a while and then see how that plays out, you know? So I try and take that advice myself, but I think that's the hardest advice for a writer to take, is to kind of grasp the fear of the unknown, of the problems that you don't know how to fix immediately.
Sounds like life.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. Jessica, thank you so much for coming in. Really
Thanks,
enjoyed
John.
Your choices tonight. Your last choice is Avalanche. Just tell me about this.
These are a really young new band. They're fantastic. And this song, I think, is a really, really intelligent response to the Me Too movement. So, you know, feels apt at the moment.
Avalanche, Another Sky. Jessica Traynor, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.